Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. All right, welcome back to my house. How are you doing?
I'm back.
I feel like you were here, it must have been like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't long ago.
It wasn't long ago,
so we're back again. We're one day away from our America trip.
Let's go.
And by the time you're seeing this, we will be in the United States. In fact, we will probably be at the Berkshire meeting by the time this goes out, I would think. Or not yet.
Not quite. Yeah. Lid, I think this will go out. Is it Thursday?
I'm forgetting. Forgetting time zones.
Time zone difference. Yeah. So it'll be like the day before the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting. So
yes,
that is very, very exciting.
Yeah. We're both kind of speaking before. It hasn't quite hit us yet, I don't think, we're traveling. It's been kind of busy over the last couple of weeks and it's all kind of thrown together. So it's all been happening. Once we get on the plane, I think it's just been a relentless
to-do list. Yes. So I think it's hard to get excited about things if you can't really enjoy it yet. It's just like, what's the next thing?
Yeah.
Now I've got to do this. Now I've got to do that. Got to get the links. Got to do the travel insurance. Got to get this. Got to do that. Got to finish my video before I leave. Got to make sure my flights are all. But I think once we hit tarmac in Omaha, it'll be like, here we go.
It'll be like that'll be great.
Yeah.
It is crazy. I mean, as soon as we get there as well, we're straight into some of the stuff we've got organized. It's jam-packed.
So we're going to a barbecue with Matt Peterson.
Correct. Yep.
That's like straight off the plane.
Yeah. So I think
we go to the accommodation, we go straight to the barbecue.
Correct. Yeah.
That's Thursday night.
That's Thursday night. Yeah, so we get off the plane at 4, hopefully, with no delays, and then we go straight there. Basically, straight there.
Yeah, very. Basically. Yeah, we might be zombies.
Depending on how much sleep we get, depending on how we show up to that. But that'll be Thursday night. It's always fun. We went last year, and it was a great time.
A lot of great networking. It was really good fun. I don't know what's going on Friday. Friday night, we're going to the Aquamarine Fund dinner, which is going to be awesome. We're going to be wining and dining with Mr. Guy Spear himself. Well, exactly. Look at us, aren't we fancy?
Yep. Imagine it's just him and then us two.
Do you have a table for three? That'd be so funny. Yeah. But that should be really cool. And then, so that'll be Friday. I want to catch up with Brett from CEO of Kelly Partners. Brett Kelly. We were hanging out with him in Omaha last year and he is such a cool guy. Yep. He is such a cool CEO, man. Yeah. We learned so much from him standing in line. I think we've told this story before.
Yeah, we have.
So that was really cool. Hopefully we catch up with him before the meeting as well. And then Saturday, it's just all systems go.
What time did we get up last time? It must have been between like 3 and 4, I think, right?
We left pretty early. We were there pretty early.
So we'll get up early, line up, and we were pretty lucky last time. We got there and we were right at the front of the line. So I would imagine it's probably going to be busier this year. So we'll probably either get up a bit earlier or just kind of see where we find ourselves in the line. But
Because last year there were still kind of COVID hoops to jump through, which I think kind of kept a fair few people away. Yes. There's still a lot of people there, but I think it did keep some away. So it'll be really interesting to see how many people are there this time around.
Yeah.
Sounds like there's kind of, it's going to be
like
quite
there's a lot.
The congregation.
I don't know about you, but just in terms of people messaging other content creators, podcasters, just there's all of the discussion has been, I've seen a lot more of it. And I know we've done a bit more speaking about it leading up to it. So that's probably playing a role.
Yeah.
But it does certainly feel like there's going to be a lot of people there.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
But anyway, we still have, so that's what we're going to be doing. Literally I'm here in Melbourne because I've flown here from Canberra to link up with Hamish. And now we're going over to Omaha tomorrow morning. So it's currently 8 o'clock at night.
We talk about doing afternoon podcasts are hard. This is very difficult.
Hamish is saying just to me before, like, man, this is going to be a rough podcast because I am asleep.
Yeah. Well, I normally wind down pretty early because I like to get work done in the morning and then I usually finish in the afternoon. So I'm like, by the time it gets to 8 o'clock, I'm usually fully wound down, kind of really prepping for the next day. So yeah, it's this is a late one, but yeah, we'll push through.
But I don't know. I'm definitely, because that's the thing, we're trying to adjust to Omaha time and we are on the east coast of Australia. So I think I'm just going to stay up tonight. I think I'm just going to do the Mr. Bean, keep the eyes open.
I think, what are we working with? Like a 9-hour time difference?
Is it 9? Okay.
Something in that ballpark.
So I think I'm just going to stay up all night. We'll go to the lounge tomorrow morning, have just a massive feed at the lounge, get on the plane at 10 and then just...
And just
wake up in America. Fingers crossed. That's not going to happen at all. I'm so bad at sleeping on flights. But if all goes well, fill up my belly, conk out on the plane, wake up in America.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
That's the dream.
That's not going to happen.
We'll see what happens. But anyway, in the meantime, we do have your weekly Young Investors podcast episode. And there's been... some interesting things are happening in the markets. Probably the biggest story this week is, of course, another regional bank in the United States has collapsed.
Yes.
That being First Republic, which is a name that you might kind of remember because it was kind of hanging on the edge of some of the other banks we were talking about back in March with SVB and Signature.
Yep.
So yeah, lots been happening over the last couple of weeks. We'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. What have you got?
I'm talking about a new Hindenburg Research report that's just come out. You remember the guys that did the Adani report?
Yes.
And just like destroyed their stock, like halved their whole company.
Yeah.
They've put out another one against a very notable investor. So we'll talk about that.
Interesting.
Maybe we'll get time to talk about some ChatGPT stuff, which is kind of interesting, I thought. And if we get time, we might talk about Australian interest rate hike.
Correct.
Because that's just, you were raging before. You should have seen Hamish downstairs before. No. How do they not see it coming?
Me getting angry at interest rates.
It's okay, buddy. But no, so we'll see what we get through, and we'll try and get through maybe some questions at the end. But with that said, we are going to get into the sponsor segment, and of course, this whole trip that we're going on, the next 3 podcasts that we're doing, all of the content that's over on our channels at the moment, this whole Berkshire trip is brought to you by a new sponsor, at least for the podcast, and that is Seeking Alpha.
Hamish and Brandon's Berkshire Bonanza 2023 is brought to you by Seeking Alpha. Try Seeking Alpha Premium today to access Seeking Alpha's rating system, valuation breakdowns, 10 years of financial data, unlimited news and analysis articles, plus have earnings call transcripts, investor presentations, SEC filings, and press releases all in the one place. With the suite of tools that come with Seeking Alpha Premium, you can be confident no matter what company you're looking at, you'll be able to get up to speed fast. But the best thing about our partnership is if you sign up with our referral link, you can access a 14-day free trial of Seeking Alpha Premium. So go check them out, give Seeking Alpha Premium a go for yourself, and now let's get back to it.
So yes, thank you very much to Seeking Alpha for sponsoring the trip. It's so amazing to have a major sponsor for a trip like this.
It's a big relief, helps with planning. Everything is, definitely a lot more organized because of that.
So good. Yeah, so good. And it's kind of crazy. I never thought we'd be able to do that.
No,
we're essentially, reality, we're getting paid to go to America to make content about this event for you guys. That is so cool. That just blows my mind.
It is crazy. If you'd told me that we were doing this, a couple of years ago, or this was going to happen. It is crazy. It just feels like time has flown and the things we can do is pretty cool.
Yeah. Even last year, we were just like, oh my God, like we got to, count every dollar. We got to, because we were funding it out. We were like, we got to go to the meeting. We've got to go. No matter what the cost, we got to get there. But now, absolutely amazing. So thank you very much, Seeking Alpha.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, Hamish. Please, will you tell me about this First Republic collapse?
Yes.
What is going on?
Yeah. So we had obviously a lot of banking news back in March. We had kind of SVB, Signature were the big ones, the two notable ones in the US. And that was kind of then followed a little bit after by Credit Suisse, this big Swiss bank that was taken over by UBS in the end. And then things kind of quietened down for a little bit. So, we're kind of back. Unfortunately, this banking crisis isn't over. And this time it is First Republic, which has collapsed. So I'll kind of talk through what happened with First Republic and how it collapsed and also what's happening with it, kind of deposits being secured and that sort of thing.
Yep, cool.
So essentially, this is actually now the second largest US banking failure after Washington Mutual, which failed in 2008.
Right.
So it actually is bigger in terms of a failure than SVB, which was previously, you know, just a month ago, set the record for the second largest banking failure.
So, SVB CEOs being like, phew, we were the second.
We're down to three.
Yeah.
How low can we go?
another one comes along and then we don't even make the podium.
So, essentially, massive banking failure. This is, you know, big news. And yeah, as I said, if you'd heard about First Republic, you know, back a month ago, it's probably in relation to SVB and Signature. And at the time, they actually got a $30 billion injection of cash.
I remember
from 11 different banks, which kind of came together and saw that First Republic was, you know, in a bit of trouble and potentially heading down the road of SVB.
Mm.
And would have been worse because it.
I think that was led by JP Morgan.
So it was 11 different banks, including JP Morgan, which will be important kind of later in the story. But the kind of the biggest contributors were the four big banks in the US: JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, who all provided $5 billion of uninsured deposits each. And then on top of that, you had Goldman Sachs and a couple of other kind of investment and banks that kind of chipped in as well to kind of stem the. Ultimately, just to stem the panic.
Yep.
And it seemed to work at the time. We obviously didn't see First Republic fail a month ago. However, since then, things have, of course, unfortunately, developed.
Uh-oh.
So this kind of all, the story kind of, again, kicked off about 2 weeks ago in the first, when they reported their first quarter earnings. They revealed that their deposits, had withdrawals of deposits of $100 billion in the quarter. Which represented 41% of their deposits declining in 3 months.
Sheesh.
Which is not great.
No, that's a lot.
So, yeah. So, of course, you know, it'd all been kind of quiet. Everyone just kind of waiting for banking earnings to come. Mm. And then all of a sudden...
they see this.
Everyone kind of sees exactly how bad it is.
Yeah.
And management seemed to kind of indicate that things... were bad, but not, you know, I guess they weren't at a critical point where the bank would actually go under. Mm. They announced they were going to lay off 25% of their workforce, and, you know, a number of other initiatives to kind of, you know, fix their situation.
Yep.
But that was the beginning of the trouble. The stock fell 50% on earnings. And the stock was already down 90% from February.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, in a couple of months now, they were down kind of 95%.
Wow.
From there, the stock slid another 60% over last week.
Yep.
As kind of concerns continue to snowball. Yeah. And, you know, of course, a bank brings out earnings and it looks like a lot of people are withdrawing. Of course, it's going to cause more
investors
people to
worried.
Withdraw.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, investors are concerned, customers are concerned. Mm. It just made things worse. And ultimately, the FDIC announced last week that they had taken over the bank to prevent any further issues. So,
right. Okay.
They stepped in and took control of the bank, took control of the situation.
Yeah.
So that kind of led up until last week. And then, of course, in true banking crisis style, over the weekend, everyone, while the banks are kind of closed or not used as much, everyone tries to scramble and get things fixed with banks over the weekend.
Yeah, it seems to be that way.
it's funny.
It's like when Friday comes, they're all just like, whew, and they're like, all right, guys, we've got 2 days.
Okay, so no one else can withdraw now? Time to announce the trouble we're really in. Yeah. So over the weekend, a number of bids kind of came in. FDIC trying to look for some deals to kind of sell off some of the assets or potentially the whole bank. And on Monday, it was announced that First Republic had been auctioned off to JP Morgan.
Right.
Which, as kind of we mentioned earlier, was one of the big banks involved in the cash injection.
So the FDIC comes in and takes over First Republic.
Yes.
And then, so they've got this bank and they're like, oh, what do we do with it?
Yeah.
It's bust. And then JP Morgan comes in and makes an offer to the FDIC to buy First Republic off of the FDIC.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. And these deals are not, you know, simple. They're complex. It's not necessarily we're going to buy all of the assets and all the liabilities of that bank. Okay. They might buy, you know, just some portion of the bank. The deals are it's really just a matter of which deal.
It's been a bit weird.
It is a little bit weird. Yeah. So essentially, they ended up paying $10.6 billion for the bank, which is why that kind of number is notable. Is it's actually 15 times higher than the market cap of the stock before it was taken over by the FDIC, which is quite unusual. Mm. Why would they pay, you know, such a significant premium to the kind of market price of a bank? The reason for it is because, you know, kind of as I was alluding to, there was some benefits kind of spun into the deal with the FDIC. So one of the biggest benefits is that they won't be taking on any of the corporate debt or the preferred shares. So those are, you know, big liabilities that the bank had that the FDIC will actually be financing with the FDIC's funds. So the FDIC is this kind of insurance fund, you know, somewhat of an insurance operation financed by the banks. Right. And it's there for these specific kind of things. So the FDIC will kind of take those liabilities and in exchange, of course, JP Morgan pays a premium.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense because JP Morgan's getting this better asset, but they don't have to, they're kind of like, sure, we're one of the big banks, so we have to kind of finance the FDIC and the liabilities of it, but we're in that pool of everybody else that has to do that as well.
Yes.
So yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, in the end, JP Morgan is not really buying the terrible bank that it was when it collapsed.
Liability-stricken.
Yeah, they're buying a reasonable institution. And the most important thing is they're a massive bank that can provide the liquidity and is unlikely to face a bank run like some of these smaller regional banks.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Wow. Okay. Yeah. It's really going down.
Yeah, so...
It has gone down.
It has gone down. In terms of what happens to shareholders, people might be curious, you know, how does this even work? Well, the moment that the FDIC takes over from the bank, it's almost a certainty that the shareholders would be completely wiped out. So it's not as if JP Morgan's paying $10.6 billion and it's going to the shareholders.
It's not a bailout.
FDIC has, no, the FDIC has already taken the bank from shareholders.
Yeah,
like the FDIC basically owns the bank. And so they're the ones that are making the deal with JP Morgan, not the shareholders.
Right, okay.
It is complicated, but...
It makes sense, yeah. It's like the FDIC is bought or not even bought out, but it's just taken it. It's like, sorry, you're gone. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What else is there to talk about on the front of this deal?
Yeah.
How is it taken?
I don't know. I don't want to kind of go into too much detail here. How long have we been going for? Not too long. But in terms of why did it fail, it's interesting because in some aspects it's quite similar to SVB, but in others it's quite different. So they actually had quite good customers. So they had high net worth individuals, which is quite different to SVB, which had, it was kind of all these Silicon Valley unprofitable tech companies that were kind of all getting crushed at the same time. Mm-hmm. Whereas high net worth individuals are obviously some people in this crisis that are very unlikely to want to or need to withdraw money.
Yep.
But they did have...
But, hey, wait.
That's the 8.30 p.m. podcast talking. They did have a very high amount of uninsured deposits. So they had 67.7% of their deposits uninsured. So that obviously adds some uncertainty to customers who know that a lot of their deposits are not insured, more likely to want to withdraw and protect their money. And they also had... quite a significant amount of unrealized losses on held to maturity securities.
Similar story to what happened with SVB, I guess, in that aspect.
Yeah. So I won't kind of spend too much time going over the unrealized losses stuff because we've spoken a lot about it over, you know, the previous crisis. But the key difference is that SVB had a lot of government bonds that had unrealized losses. Whereas in this case, it's more about mortgage-backed securities.
Right. So that a little bit of government bonds, but not that's really pushed to the side, and it's more mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah. So the difference here was First Republic issued a lot of single-family, you know, property mortgages, which again, are fine. Most people kind of pay their mortgages. They're these long-term securities. But the issue again is that once they're kind of bundled into mortgage-backed securities, if a lot of people are withdrawing money, they need to sell a lot of these assets very quickly. And those mortgage-backed securities experience the exact same thing as government bonds, which is as interest rates rise, the value of them in the open market goes down. Right. Of course, if they were able to just hold those mortgages until people paid them, they'd be completely fine, in the same way as the US government's very likely to pay on those bonds.
Yep.
Because they needed the liquidity, they'd be selling in the open market at a significant discount. So it's a very similar issue, just a different type of asset that's experienced.
But it's the same story. On the books, the value looks fine. In the market, the value's not fine.
Yeah.
Right.
And it does speak to this whole issue, because that's kind of an accounting principle that these banks can use, is if they're intending to hold those assets to maturity, then they're recorded on the balance sheet at held to maturity value,
yeah,
and they don't have to record the losses in their profit and loss. So this kind of speaks to what Warren Buffett was talking about in his interview, which is banks getting obsessive over the bottom line are more likely to hide some of these losses rather than display them, you know,
openly
in the way that they should be.
Yeah. And that makes sense, because it's not a realized loss. It's an unrealized loss. And it's actually, if they could hold to maturity, it will never be a realized loss.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If no one panics.
This
all works. Yeah. If there isn't a banking crisis.
No one panics. Yeah. If nobody tries to withdraw their money.
It is funny that, because then, you know, it speaks to the whole game theory thing, which is like, well, if everyone just doesn't panic, but it's like, well, how do I know that you're not panicking?
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do. Like, if we both don't withdraw, we're fine. But I don't know if you're going to withdraw, so I'm going to withdraw.
No, and that's the whole thing. Like, banking, it's so interesting. The whole idea of like fractional reserve banking, how they like don't, you know, money comes in through depositors and then they dish it all out, loan it all out. So really there's not a lot of money in the bank at all.
No.
But it's so interesting that this system just works perfectly, except in one instance where everybody shows up at the same time and demands their money. So it's just so like all these banking crises, so psychological. And that's exactly what we've seen play out, like with the Fed saying, look, no, it's fine. You know, we'll cover all of SVB's deposits, with them coming out and saying that financial institutions can just borrow from us at par value, as opposed to like whatever the market value, like you can just borrow. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. That's all like psychological. That's just the Fed being like, no, we need to make sure that people en masse don't panic.
And even on top of that, it's if there was a lot of people withdrawing but interest rates hadn't risen dramatically, they would be able to sell a lot of these long-term government bonds and mortgage-backed securities at prices similar to what they sold, they listed at in their books.
Yep.
Whereas it's like, it's the two issues at the same time. It's like panic and the value of the assets are down because of this rapid rate hike environment that we're unfortunately in.
So the key is don't panic.
Don't panic, guys.
Did I have anything? Did I have anything else to say? That's about it. Unless you had anything else to add on
that's,
that.
That's it. So yeah, I guess we'll kind of, again, we'll see how this plays out. And unfortunately, it means, you know, potentially there's more banking failures to come in the US. We don't really know. It's like there was quite a bit of, it seems like the SVB issue kind of caused First Republic to ultimately have a lot of withdrawals. So now will we see First Republic cause the same thing to other banks potentially?
It's so interesting, because like, does their Q1 report coming out now trigger other people at other banks? And, you know, does that trigger other people at other banks to withdraw their money, and then in the next quarterly earnings those banks show more withdrawals, and then that triggers everybody else? It's like, oh my god. So it's just it could be a snowball. And then of course the annoying thing is then you get the media as the compounding factor.
Yes,
because the media, like, you know, the psychology, how headlines are always biased negatively because more people are likely to click on it. It's kind of like if you hear positive news it doesn't really stick with you, if you hear negative news it does. So all the media is just like cycling through banking crisis, worst day of your life, you know, interest rates through the roof, banking crisis, banks going bust, you're gonna die.
I do wonder if like the internet and social media plays, you know, a role in making things worse, because there is just a lot of faster movement of information. People kind of have immediate access to all news, and I think obviously having access to more information and what's going on in the world is great, but it's potentially has its negatives when we're talking about things like this, where everyone kind of thinking that things are going to collapse is, you know, very likely to cause it to collapse.
Greater liquidity of information. Yeah, there you go. So very interesting. So that First Republic is Gornsky's and then bought off the FDIC. Very interesting. So now I think Richard was saying in his video that like all First Republic branches, they're just like overnight, just take, can you take down that signage, just put up JP Morgan?
Yeah, just cross
it's like they're
out.
Immediately now just JP Morgan branches.
That's crazy.
I know you worked for First Republic yesterday, but now you work for JP Morgan. That'd be so weird.
Yeah.
Hello, welcome to JP Morgan. But yeah, oh, there you go.
That's great.
All right, should we move on?
Yeah, tell me about this Hindenburg research report.
Interesting. They are going after, they are firing shots at a very, very famous investor by the name of Carl Icahn.
Mr. Carl Icahn.
Yeah, yeah. So it says, notable short seller Hindenburg Research is going after famed activist investor Carl Icahn, very, very wealthy man. And this is, as I said before, the same short selling research firm that went after the Adani Group. Or they didn't. They put out their big report on the Adani Group.
They didn't go after
them. No, they put out their big report on their short report on their long short report on Adani, which basically halved Adani's stock price.
Yeah.
And that's the thing to, I'll talk about this a little bit later. That's the thing to remember is that this report is being put out by a research firm. That what they do is they go in, they research a company that's probably going to blow up or has a little bit of smoke, and then they form a massive short position, and then they publish their findings to everybody, and then they hope that the stock price goes down. There's always that to just remember, and it kind of raises the ethical question of like short selling, what role does it play? Does it get abused? That kind of thing. Anyway.
Yeah.
So it says the Nathan Anderson-led firm took a short position against Icahn Enterprises, alleging inflated asset valuations, among other reasons, for what it says is an unusually high net asset value premium in shares of the publicly traded holding company. Mm. Now, I haven't read the full report yet. It looked very interesting, but I have kind of skimmed it. So the Cliff Notes version is that they basically describe instances where they believe Icahn is overinflating the value of assets on their books. Right. And on top of that, they also think he's taken on a lot of too much leverage and is in a bit of a hot spot regarding all that debt. So the report, like for instance, the report notes, we estimate IEP, so Icahn Enterprises, IEP's last reported indicative net asset value of $5.6 billion is inflated by at least 22% owing to a combination of overly aggressive marks on IEP's less liquid / private investments and continued year-to-date underperformance. So they give examples for like of how their real estate portfolio has been reported at a very similar value for a number of years, despite declining net income and despite including Trump Plaza in Atlantic City, which, quote, this is from their research report, was razed to the ground in 2021. It just, it's not there anymore.
That's great.
Yeah. So they also note IEP's automotive parts division was valued at $381 million in December of 2022 when its key subsidiary declared bankruptcy a month later. So it's like, what? Is it really that valuable? Another example is the IEP owns 90% of a publicly traded meat packaging business that it valued at $243 million at year end. But they own 90%. The company had a market value of only $89 million at the time. So, you know, where there's smoke.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a story. And Hindenburg Research are good at just like, just throwing things out. Like, yeah, they're just like, and by the way,
look at this.
Look at this. Well, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, so. It is interesting because especially when you get into the value of private property, private investments, it's very difficult to come up with an idea. I mean, even if we're looking at public investments, a lot of the time you could say, okay, that stock price reflects the some of this short-term uncertainty. And maybe even the stock price doesn't really reflect the true value of the business, whether it's on the upside or the downside. But that's, you know, even compounded when you have, you know, private investments, equity investments, where you don't have a market of people all trying to figure out what it's worth. That's kind of one of the benefits of the stock market is you have so many smart people trying to figure out and price where it's worth. Mm. Whereas, even without that, it's very hard for businesses to value things.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is it's very easy to misvalue things either, you know, in your favor.
Yeah, and it comes back down to like even reporting, like publicly traded companies is reporting their cash flows. We can figure it out, like what's reasonable, where what's a reasonable valuation for this company based on the current cash flows kind of thing, or expected future cash flows. Anyway, where was I at? So there's weird instances of values of their assets being a little inflated. The report says, overall, we estimate IEP's current net asset value as being closer to $4.4 billion or 22% lower than its disclosed year-end indicative net asset value of $5.6 billion. The analysis suggests that units currently trade at a 310% premium to net asset value, with an annual dividend rate of 64% of net asset value. Hmm. Things are a little bit spicy, a little bit overinflated, just a tad. In the report, they also go on to talk about how Icahn's enterprises are also highly levered and how they're worried about the company having to pay a substantially higher interest rate when they refinance. They also note that Carl isn't in a great position to give the company a massive injection of capital because 85% of his net worth is tied up in the stock.
Right.
They say, quote, we think unit holders deserve this info to understand the risk of margin calls should IEP units revert towards net asset value, a reality we see as inevitable when we publish this research report. Now, they didn't say that last bit, but that's exactly what happened.
How generous of them to serve up all this information.
Yeah. And this is exactly why our thesis is going to come true when we publish this report and the share price tanks. Anyway, what else was that? Yeah, quote, given limited financial flexibility and worsening liquidity, we expect Icahn Enterprises will eventually cut or eliminate its dividend entirely. Don't say that to your grandma. Shh, keep it. No. Yeah. barring a miracle turnaround in investment performance. Overall, we think Icahn, a legend of Wall Street, has made a classic mistake of taking on too much leverage in the face of sustained losses, a combination that rarely ends well. Hindenburg Research said. Yes. And yeah, this is what I was just going to note. I kind of already talked about it. These reports by Hindenburg, they're always very, very interesting. But there is always the other side of the equation to consider as well, to kind of be balanced. Like, I get it. Where there's smoke, there's usually fire. But there is the other side of the equation. For example, the shares of Icahn Enterprises, when this research report dropped, the shares fell 20%, like just like that. So Hindenburg Research, They've done it. They've won. Well done. Again.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy now. They've kind of figured out a money printing strategy because now they've kind of got that I don't know, they've released a couple of big reports.
They've got a reputation.
They've got the reputation. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Buffett effect in a way where, every time
it's
you
the
buy
reverse
something.
Buffett effect.
It is. It's the reverse Buffett effect. Yeah.
They come out with a research report, the company's shares plummet.
Yeah.
And that's what they want because they are a short selling research firm. So they get into big short positions in these companies they're researching. Mm. And then once they've established these short positions, they publish all this data so that everybody can have a look at it. And then it's inevitably everybody looks at it and goes, oh my gosh, that looks terrible. Sell, 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 sell.
Yeah.
And then the stock price goes down and Hindenburg Research goes, all right, sweet. We just printed our money. You know, fantastic.
We're done. Where's the next one?
Yeah. Where's the next one? We're millionaires now. Great. So there is that factor to consider. So you could make an argument that maybe even if they can't quite prove something negative, they might just like throw it out there. Just be like, look, we're not saying it's fraud, but it looks a little like fraud. And then everyone's like, fraud, you know? So there is that. And that's kind of the age old debate with short selling, how sometimes big short sellers have so much money on the line. They need the stock price to go down. So they'll go on CNBC and just say anything. Yeah. Like they'll be like, oh, this is Elon Musk, you know, something horrendous about him. You know, did you know that he's entangled in some money laundering conspiracy or something like that?
Bill Ackman crying on CNBC.
So, yeah, there's always that. And I should say ICANN responded in a statement saying the Hindenburg report was intended solely to generate profits on its short position at the expense of ICANN Enterprises' long-term stakeholders. Of course, he would say that. But, you know, let's say that nothing in the report is true. It's all just false. I mean, yeah, that would be if that happened. And it does happen because some of these short sellers are just horrific. They'll just say whatever to try and influence the stock price. And a lot of that, that happened quite extensively to Tesla when it was really heavily shorted. And it is very rough to continuing shareholders, long-term shareholders of a company, because they can just get screwed when really the company's done nothing wrong, especially if there's like coordinated short seller attacking kind of thing. But
For sure.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all I had to say on it. I don't know whether it's, I guess we'll find out whether it's right or wrong over the long term.
Yeah. I guess we probably didn't really hear too much about Adani since that kind of, that whole story happened.
Share price is still, I looked at the share price before, still gone.
Decimated. Like,
decimated. But
yeah. So I mean, yeah, a lot of these things you wouldn't really, even if there was, you know, fire, so to speak, you wouldn't expect things to unfold for a while. You're not expecting things to just collapse immediately. So we just kind of have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, so that is Hindenburg's report on ICANN Enterprises. So yeah, we'll see what happens. Interesting that I don't think Carl Icahn's actually come out and given like a proper, you remember how Adani came back and gave like a massive report, like a rebuttal? Carl Icahn hasn't done that. I mean, maybe that's just him going, they've got nothing, whatever, like I don't care.
You know, interesting.
Or maybe it's just like,
wait a second. Yeah. They're right. No.
Larry, are you telling me? What? Just like, sorry, Carl. When you were off in the Bahamas. Anyway.
A few things have changed.
No, yeah. Where should we pivot?
Pivot
from here. Pivot.
let's do a bit of Australian news because it was a big story in Australia this week, which was that there was a interest rate decision made by the Reserve Bank of Australia, and they decided to raise rates again. So they raised the official cash rate by 25 basis points. I know it may shock you. Well, okay, we'll get into it. I won't jump out of my seat yet.
I triggered you so easily just then.
It's like a flinch. Bringing the cash rate to 3.85%. Of course, this comes after last month where there was no rate hike. So there was a pause last month. The RBA thought that given, you know, everything happening in the banking crisis that it was kind of worth holding and just kind of waiting to see if things got a lot worse. And they didn't. So they decided to resume their rate raises. Interestingly, only Commonwealth Bank predicted the rate hike. Out of the four major banks in Australia, three of them were expecting a hold. And that's why you may have very well seen kind of leading up to this on the news that it was expected that rates were going to stay the same. Mm. And it's also why you're probably now seeing every headline say shocked that rates have gone up, which was interesting. Yeah, you're right. It was kind of triggering me because...
Is it shocking?
It shouldn't be shocking.
Were you shocked?
No, I wasn't.
No, and, me neither.
I think it's not super simple, but it is a relatively simple equation, which is the RBA is looking at really two things. One is unemployment, so that kind of the health of the economy, and inflation. And we have record low unemployment, so we're in a very good employment situation. But inflation is still very, very high. And that is a very easy decision for the RBA to say, let's keep raising rates.
Yeah.
The economy is still in incredible health. Businesses aren't laying people off in a big way yet. And we've still got this, you know, cost of living crisis. So, you know, it's a pretty simple equation.
It's not hard.
Yeah, so it was interesting to kind of see, at least for me, over the past couple of days, that this was surprising to you know, to most people.
It's crazy that the media was just like, "This is outrageous! We didn't see it coming." You know, blindsided, backstab. You know,
yeah.
It's like, what?
Yeah, it is interesting to see that because, yeah, of course, you know, this does continue to increase the you know, cost of interest on mortgages for people. So on a $500,000 mortgage, for example, the increase will be about $80 per month. Mm-hmm. And now in total, since early 2022, a $500,000 mortgage has seen an increase of $1,058 approximately per month,
right,
which is massive. But at the same time, you know, inflation is also, I know, a massive cost of living increase. And if we don't get it under control, and that's what the RBA is looking at, then, you know, that's not just a couple of rate hikes. That's compounding cost of food, cost of petrol, that kind of thing.
And it's interesting. I've got a lot of friends that are now homeowners and they kind of say, oh, you know, why does the RBA keep doing this to us? But it's crazy that people don't understand that that is the point. Like the point of, I know it's painful for people that, you know, have mortgages, but the point of them raising rates is to inflict financial hardship on you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a sad situation. It's a sad reality, but that's what they're trying to do because they are trying to cool the economy. They're trying to, if inflation's rocketing, that means the economy is just racing. It's too hot. Like companies just raise and raise prices and their demand is there. It's crazy. Or the supply is shocked. One of those two or both of those factors. So they need to put a clamp on people to say, no, no, no. It's essentially like, we are taking your free money away from you so that you cannot spend it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, kind of to put that in perspective, there's an electronics retailer in Australia called JB Hi-Fi who reported their sales for the quarter. And their sales were flat over the quarter, but they showed that their sales are still 38.8% higher than before the pandemic.
Wow.
That is a massive, you know, a significantly higher level of willingness to spend on consumer electronics than even before the pandemic. And that is because, it's just a demonstration of that strong willingness.
Yeah.
And that's what needs to be curbed in order for inflation to come down.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, for international viewers, like what's a comparable business in America? I don't really know.
Best Buy.
It's like Australia's main general electronics retailer.
Yeah.
You know, you go there and you get
computers, game, laptops, stuff,
games, you know, music, even like vacuum cleaners, CDs.
They've got everything and they've headphones. Got a sale on at the moment. No, I'm just kidding. It's not an ad.
Yeah. And this episode is brought to you by JB Hi-Fi.
No, but yeah, Australia is kind of just in one of those positions where on average, and this obviously isn't the case for every individual person, but on average, Australians have had much higher levels of savings kind of going into the pandemic and then through the pandemic because of stimulus and work from home and that sort of thing. And the result of that is even with these price increases, there's still considerable demand for goods and services, and that balance needs to be kind of shifted. So you would expect rate hikes to continue.
Yeah. Very interesting. That is quite the stat. 38.8% higher sales than before the pandemic.
Yep.
That is evidence right there that we are still spending all our money. All right. you like that one?
Yeah, where should we go from here?
I just had this quick thing that just caught my eye. It's nothing too crazy, so we won't spend a lot of time on it. But it's an interesting, like ChatGPT, we know it's going to destroy some businesses. It's kind of already started. Which is pretty ridiculous because it was only released, 6 months ago, maybe?
Yeah.
It's only like 6 months old.
It really has taken the world by storm.
Yeah. It's pretty fresh still.
Yeah.
And we always talk about like, oh, AI is going to take over these jobs and kill these businesses. It's crazy to see that it's already starting to happen like immediately. It's a little bit of a funny one, which we'll get to, but it is still interesting that's happening slowly. So what did I say on this? I'm trying to catch up to where I'm at. So the article is titled Chegg, Chegg shares drop more than 40% after company says ChatGPT is killing its business.
Whoa.
CEO Dan Rosenweig, I'm not sure, said on an earnings call on Monday, quote, "In the first part of the year, we saw no noticeable impact from ChatGPT on our new account growth, and we were meeting expectations on new signups. However, since March, we saw a significant spike in student interest in ChatGPT. Now we believe it's having an impact on our new customer growth rate." They said revenue would be between $175 million and $178 million this quarter, far below FactSet's analyst consensus estimate of $193.6 million.
Right.
But, and I've done this quite deliberately, any guesses on what this business does?
I have no idea.
I kind of gave it away when I said student.
Oh, okay. So some kind of services, student services or something.
Exactly,
I'm guessing.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly what kids are using ChatGPT for. So it says Chegg is an American education technology company that provides various student services, including homework help, tutoring, and and online textbook rental, scholarships, and internships. But yes, homework and tutoring.
That is really interesting.
It's like of all of the businesses that are going to be first disrupted by ChatGPT, that's the one. That's the one when you just need to get some schoolwork done and you just type into ChatGPT, "Hey, teach me about ionic bonds. You know, teach me about, or write this essay for me." Of course, ChatGPT is killing them. So I said, yes, of course, they're going to get trounced by even the free version of ChatGPT. The article notes that Chegg is developing its own AI product, you'll love this, named Cheggmate, which is meant to help students with their homework. The product is built in collaboration with OpenAI, which develops ChatGPT.
Right.
However, Jefferies analyst Brent Thill says the impact of this product is uncertain. So it's kind of, if you can't beat them, join them. is their route.
Yeah,
which is kind of funny. But it got me just thinking about, like, this. If you're going to pick a business that was going to be first disrupted by ChatGPT, it was going to be this one.
Yeah.
But it kind of got me thinking, like, what else is, what's next? Like, what is next? And it's very interesting. Yeah. Like, I was having a chat with a guy. I won't name names or talk about it, but he was interested in acquiring YouTube channels.
Mm.
He kind of was saying how he'd kind of gone off the boil a little bit because with ChatGPT, they're wondering, like, how much of this is just kind of going to be automated now.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, it's interesting because there's kind of like two types of YouTube channels. There's channels with faces and personalities, kind of like ours.
Yep.
And then there's faceless voiceover B-roll kind of YouTube channels.
Yep.
And their opinion is that that side of YouTube is just going to be AI. Mm. It's just going to be taken over. So they kind of went off the boil a little bit. But where was I going with that? Yes, it definitely made me wonder, like, what's ChatGPT going to disrupt? And I'd definitely like to hear, because I haven't come up with an exhaustive list, so I'd love to hear, like, if you guys have ideas, definitely leave them in the comment section of our YouTube version of the podcast. But the immediate one that comes to mind, journalism. I reckon journalism is definitely going to cop it. I feel like authors, it's just anything writing related. Authors might be a little bit sweaty. But you've even seen things like coding as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think, with a lot of creative endeavors, they'll certainly go through a huge change. You're right. Like authors, there's going to be a huge change in the workflow for a lot of authors using, you know, AI to come up with ideas and to even write, you know, large parts of their work. And the same thing is true for, you know, other types of art. So, you know, that's certainly an area that'll be transformed a lot. Whether it kind of replaced, I don't know. It's interesting because, like, creative work, like, I guess, like, I'm thinking kind of through what we do. A lot of it is something you, at least for now, you couldn't get an AI to figure out which video is going to do the best or which is going to connect with your personal audience. And maybe over time, that is something that the AI can do.
Yeah.
But there is, it is interesting, but certainly, you know, a lot of creative work will be changing.
And then I was thinking like, all the writing. And then I was like, hang on, I've seen so many ChatGPT kind of videos about the ChatGPT just writing scripts, like coding.
Mm.
So I was like, wow, actually, does it get to a point where, you know, even app developers like or, you know, software developers are a little bit like, oh shit, because we can kind of just type into ChatGPT, hey, can you build this app? I need it to do this. I need it to look like this. And then ChatGPT is just like, all right, I'll just work on the code. Done.
So it's definitely going to make coding way more efficient. Like
very efficient.
Think about the time saved once it gets to a point where it's not making errors.
Yeah.
The time saved on basic coding
so
that time can be spent on coding that is fidgety and fiddly and that the AI wouldn't be able to do yet.
The nuance.
Can't quite get exactly the look that they want or the action. So, yeah, it's going to unlock a huge amount of potential.
Yeah. And even just being like, here's a whole bunch of code. Can you find inefficiencies and errors?
Yeah.
And the AI can just be like, brrr. Here's so many inefficiencies. Here's an error. There's an error.
Yeah.
You know, and just like, whoop, done.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be pretty cool.
I think a lot of advice-based jobs over time will probably either be, again, kind of substituted for AI or, you know, made better with AI.
Yeah.
Things like accounting advice, legal advice. Yep. These are things where ultimately the AI will be able to draw on case law and everything from the internet and probably come up with a fuller answer than somebody who's probably read a lot of the case law but might have missed this particular thing that happened 47 years ago that actually applies to this very specific circumstance.
It kind of eliminates the, oh, I haven't read that. It kind of eliminates that because the AI can just be like, yeah, I'm reading everything at the same time right now. Yeah,
immediately.
Or, yeah.
Yes.
It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that, actually, now that you mention it. It's like AI just gets rid of all of that.
Yeah, because, I mean, especially with law, I mean, the best lawyers are the ones that have the biggest case knowledge and can specifically and figure out which cases apply to this very specific circumstances for the particular suit. I mean, you're going to have AI eventually that will just be better than most lawyers, if not all of them.
Yeah. It's so interesting. It's very, very interesting. I love thinking about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely like to hear from you guys as well. So if you have any of that stuff, how is AI, like, what jobs do you feel like AI can disrupt? Maybe even some like quirky ones, ones that are maybe not people don't expect, like journalism, everyone's kind of expecting it. Maybe you can think of like where ChatGPT or an AI could disrupt an industry. Or maybe your industry. Definitely let us know. But with that said, Hamish, that is pretty much the news that we've got for today. Shall we finish off with a couple of questions?
I think we should, yes. Okay. I'll ask this first one.
And we should say, please leave your questions down in the comment section of the YouTube video. Go to the most recent YouTube version of the podcast, whatever's most recent, and leave a question down there. Or there's a question box on the Spotify version of the podcast as well. So you can drop that stuff there.
Yeah, especially if you have questions kind of relating to Berkshire while we're over in the US.
Yeah.
You know, any questions are always welcome. But
anything about our trip?
Yeah, related to the trip, kind of go seamlessly, nicely into
discussion topics. Doesn't have to be a question. Just be like, I'd like to hear you guys discuss blah, blah, blah. Yeah, definitely. Yep. Sorry, cut you off.
So we've got two questions here from this person. Hi, I love your weekly podcast. And this time I'm excited because I have a question for you. Well, thank you for asking your questions. First question is, where do you get ideas for companies to look into?
Okay, we'll just start there.
We'll
start there. For me, it's always, I feel like I've said this a lot of times, so maybe people know exactly what I'm about to say. For me, it's always circle of competence. It's interest, because personally, this is what I find anyway. If I try and read about a company that I just don't care about, maybe it's the most undervalued company out there, but if I just don't care about it, I'm like reading through the annual reports, like reading through what the business does, and my brain is just like, it just dances off. It's thinking about football. It's thinking about video games. It's thinking about other stuff. I just find it too boring. And if you're finding it boring, then you inevitably don't go into enough detail because you're not enjoying the process of discovering new nuggets of information. So for me personally, maybe this is not the best, but it's the best approach for me anyway. I have to start with things that I'm really interested in, or maybe not even companies that I'm interested in, but just like areas of business that I'm interested in. Like I play video games all the time. Okay, cool. Let's look into video game companies. And then just go from there. And you can just literally Google video game stocks. Video game stocks.
Yep.
Microsoft comes up, of course, because they have Xbox. Activision Blizzard, Electronic Arts, Take-Two Interactive, Tencent. Yep. And you can just go, oh, hang on. Yeah, Activision Blizzard. Oh, they make Call of Duty. I love Call of Duty. That's a big part of their business. You already have that kind of familiarity with how the business kind of runs.
Yeah.
And then from there, when you start reading, you're actually like, oh, this is actually really interesting. I didn't know that they own World of Warcraft as well, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And to tack onto that, it's not just, so you mentioned like business, types of businesses like video games, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It can also be like the type of business model. Like if you find subscription services very interesting,
right?
You know, there's subscription services across a variety of industries, you know, media and all kinds of, all the way to accounting.
Yeah.
So if you get really good at understanding how these businesses work and what their costs are and that sort of thing, then yeah, you can potentially look at different types of subscription businesses. But the same
thing. You did that with restaurants.
I did. Yeah. So, you know, restaurants is another one. Yeah. So basically, the same principle applies. You're sticking to areas that you have some kind of expertise in, or you just find really interesting, so you can over time develop an expertise in those areas.
Yeah.
And you know, that's one way people go about it. Other people will specifically look for the metrics first and then learn the business. A lot of people do that, but I've never had any success doing that. Like you said, I just am much more engaged looking at businesses I'm already interested in. And remember, it's not just research for a week and then you're done. It's if you're going to own these companies for decades, you better damn well love them because they're going to be around for a while.
Yeah, I always think like if listening to like an earnings call is becoming a chore, then it's like, oof, you know, am I really still... for lack of a better word, am I still invested in this company?
You got to be engaged. You've got to be interested. Okay, what have they got new coming at this quarter? Or how is this thing that they've been doing progressing?
Yeah. Let me ask you the second question that this person has. Before you deep dive into a company, what are the key metrics you check first and what should they be?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think there's a few things. And as you do more and more analysis, you kind of get better at looking at figuring out what's important and looking at it very quickly.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, some of the more basic ones would be I'm looking for a company that's shown an ability to consistently grow over time. So growing revenues, growing profitability. I don't want a company that's growing revenues, but they get less and less efficient every year, that marketing spend is just going up and up and up and they're actually not producing more profit. So that's where I'm looking kind of first. Also kind of their cash flows are growing consistently over time.
It makes sense. On the up and up.
Yep. I'm looking for a company that's well managed and generates a high return on the capital that they deploy. So it's not just that they're growing over time, but they're doing it efficiently with capital so that when they reinvest money back in the business, they're getting a good return on that money. It's kind of like you think of a business as like it's kind of like a savings account where you're reinvesting, it's going to generate some kind of return.
Yep.
So you want that return internally to be good.
I also think on that, that's probably the metric that I hear most commonly recited by big name investors as their probably go-to most important metric is like the return on invested capital. How well does the company actually take the capital at their disposal and invest in the business to generate profits? Yeah.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, businesses are competing. So if businesses don't have anything special, then they're just going to be competing on the basis of price and those returns on their investments will just be going down and down and down. So companies that can generate high returns on capital consistently, they have something special that's allowing them to either price their products at a premium above competition and people still buy their products, or they have some kind of systems in place where their costs are lower or they can deploy less capital. So by definition, businesses that can generate high returns consistently, they have a deep moat. They are a good business. That's what a good business is.
Yeah.
So that definitely is by far the most important metric. And you know, if you want a specific, some, you know, maybe looking for a 15% return on invested capital or return on equity is very good. That's a very good business.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And if you're getting ones up in like the 20s or 30%, it's like, whoa.
Yeah, you have those every now and then.
Yeah.
I think Google has a pretty good return on invested capital, and Visa and MasterCard are a couple of special businesses as well that have done extremely well.
Yeah, they don't have to do it. Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about them another day maybe. Yeah. But yeah, I think actually we should wrap things up there.
Yeah.
Because that is pretty much, we got a flight to catch.
We do.
No, we don't. we're staying up all night.
Yeah, we do have a few hours to kill.
We could do like a 10-hour podcast.
Yeah, we could. Let's just keep it going.
We'll do the Joe Rogan version. No, I definitely couldn't do that.
No.
I'd definitely get sleepy.
Yeah.
Start slowing down. My thoughts aren't as good. But yes. Thank you guys very much for tuning in as always. Like I said before, any questions you have, just drop them down in the comment section of the podcast. Ask us on Spotify as well. But apart from that, wowee, we are off, hey? We are going to America tomorrow. That is so exciting. Well, as you guys hear this, we will be touching down. We'll be in America. That's the only thing that kind of sits at the back of my mind is that it's so, like, it's still so long time-wise until we actually get off the plane in Omaha.
Yep.
That's like when we sit down on the couch of the Airbnb, that's when I'm going to feel like, oh yeah,
yep,
let's go. But until then, it's just such a drag. Because what was the last time? I don't want to ramble too much. It was like over 24 hours of travel time, wasn't it?
Pretty close. I think it's 14 for the first flight and then maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah,
for
but
the
I think from
flight.
Like from when you account all the traveling that we had to do to get from our houses
and everything
to get to Omaha was like over 24 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. So it's crazy. It's pretty rough, but that's all right. But we do it for you guys.
Yeah, we do.
It's all about you. We don't take this is a slog for us.
Yeah, we hate this.
No, we love it. We absolutely love it. We're excited to go, and we're excited to bring you guys along too. We're excited to cover the whole event. So yes, stay tuned to the Young Investors podcast feed the next couple of weeks. Stay focused on our YouTube channels as well. That's where the main content's going to be coming out as per usual.
Yeah.
You can follow us on Instagram as well if you want to see the behind the scenes, the day to day, what we're doing, if we're at Chipotle having a yarn, meeting up with people, maybe if we meet famous investor Guy Spier, Monish Prabhai, maybe we'll keep all that over on our Instagram, so definitely follow us. You are
Hamish_Hotter.
I am new.money.official, spelt correctly. If it's not spelt correctly, it's not me.
That's the thing, right?
Exactly. There's a lot of impersonation.
Dodge the minefield of fake accounts.
New.money.official spelt correctly.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We're going to bounce out of here. We will see you guys next week from Omaha.